This is Kate Scott Allen of OJCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. We're back from summer break. It is August 21st, 2013, and here we go. This is a discussion show, and we're just going to kind of throw some stuff out there. So we had one listener suggestion that we talk about async versus await and callbacks and all that. This was from Richard Astbury, and I think he was referring to Miguel de Caza's post, which said something about callbacks are our generation's go-to statement. Any thoughts on that, guys?
Yeah, I thought it was a bit hyperbolic. You know, now that I'm doing primarily Node code, you know, Node has this reputation for leading to callback hell, and you can't do anything without having these huge, you know, massively indented chains of callbacks. And it's just not in real world Node programming. There's flow control libraries like async that make that a total non-issue. And maybe it's not quite as syntactically nice as async await. It totally avoids the callback hell issue, along with, you know, if you do things like, you know, always set username functions, don't use anonymous functions, and just kind of practice good code hygiene, like, makes that sort of a non-issue also. So I mean, it's nice. I'm not saying async is bad. I'm just saying I think people always throw out Node as like, oh, they make it sound like if you do this in Node, like, you're doomed to this callback hell for all eternity, and it just isn't really the case.
So I thought along with the same way that you are. Yeah, you know, if you write bad async code, then yeah, it's going to be a mess. And I have to laugh every time I see an example and someone says, oh, I got callback hell in my code. And I'm like, why are you using anonymous functions everywhere? Just put them off into a name function and just call that. And it makes it easier to read at the very least and easier to debug in 90% of the debuggers out there. But one thing that I've always wondered about, if Miguel's main point was also that the current way that we're doing async is kind of clumsy. So even though we have async and await, you kind of have to mark them, and you know, you don't quite get stuck in the callback hell, but you still have to say, okay, this is async, and what if everything was just async by default? What if the entire language and runtime was async by default, and or there was like a single global setting you could set in the compiler or in a config file or something that specified, you know,
kind of like
everything is async.
Like F# does, like immutable by default.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's like async by default. Of course, in order to enable to do that, in order to do that, I think you do have to have immutable types. Mm-hmm. I think that makes the async stuff a lot easier. Yeah. But, you know, that being said, you know, yeah, how would your Node.js program or your C# service change if you could just flip a switch and you wouldn't have to use async, await, task of T or anything anymore? It just was there and worked.
Yeah, and that brings up another thing, which is, you know, some people complain that with the async and await, you know, you have to mark things and then it kind of infects all the code, right? Because then everything starts turning async. But in a way, like you're saying, I mean, if you do kind of everything async, that kind of does push you down a better direction a lot of the time. And I think that's one thing that I do see as kind of a positive. Like, if you, like Kevin, you're talking about libraries like async, and I think with C#, like with async and await, like, you could always build your own state machine, but if it's enough of an obstacle, then you don't want to. And so you end up thinking like, oh, well, this one's probably going to be okay synchronous, you know? And whereas, like, if it's like a few characters to mark something as async, then you end up doing it that way. And then people will build APIs, you know, so that they require async. Like, all the, part of what drove it, I think, was all the Windows 8 stuff is all, you know, async everywhere. So it kind of, like, writing that without something like C# async await would just be a, you know, nightmare.
Right. And that's a little bit different in Node, because, like, Node has always been async from the beginning. There's never been an option. So you don't really have that, like, people don't sort of out of sloppiness make things synchronous.
Mm-hmm.
Just one more thing on that. The other thing about, you know, using flow control libraries like async is that, you know, the async keyword handles a very simple case, right? You're making a single async call and, you know, wait until that returns. And if you want to do more sophisticated things, like, I want to make, you know, here's five things that need to happen asynchronously, do them all and let me know when they're all done. Then you're like, then async doesn't work anymore, right?
Yeah, then you have to do like task.await all or await, you know, like So, I mean, it's not much harder, but it's not like that syntactic trigger anymore.
Right. So like when you're doing things with flow control libraries, like you can do both. Like you have the flexibility to do both. So in a way is that, you know, that approach has not syntactically nice, it's a little bit more flexible. It's the same mechanism to, you know, sort of, you know, have a sequence, or you can then say, well, no, instead of make them a sequence, I want them to all fire at the same time, or I want these two to fire after this one is finished firing, and it's all the same mechanism. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, did C# have flow control libraries like that before? And I guess the thing was, like, there were parallel extensions and stuff like that, which I guess was the main thing. I'm remembering back, the place where I first ran into this was C# and Silverlight, and it was a video player, and it seems like it would be super simple, but the whole idea was like it had to handle if one connection drops, then it throttles down to a lower bitrate and all that kind of stuff. And then you end up with these crazy, like I had so many things that required all these state machines and fallbacks and stuff where it was like, and timers, and it got like just totally insane. It was like, you know, you're always checking, did something return? Did it time out? If it didn't time out, well, is it running? You know, and it was, you know, because like it all seems simple, but like, okay, connect to the video starts playing, it stops playing. Okay, fall back to the other stream, but to do that, you have to parse the video, you know, headers, and if that fails or hangs up, then you've got it, you know what I mean? And so it's like, there's just so many things like that. So like async library and node, like that handles enough that, like, you've got all the flexibility you need, I guess.
For the most part, I mean, it's definitely, I mean, I don't know that it would handle, you know, help in that particular example, because there's all, it sounds like there's lots of other stuff going on there, but
yeah,
it certainly handles a lot of different parallelization.
I think what I really need is Windows Workflow Foundation, just built in node.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so there's kind of two scenarios we're talking about here with the, like the P-Link stuff, that's different from async on a certain level. Do you get what I'm saying? Because like with async, you know, you're just saying, all right, you know, whenever this happens, call me back. But with like P-Link, you're saying, hey, go do all these things, and when all of you are done, then we'll go on. Does that kind of that make sense?
Right.
It does.
And you know, I mean, that if you'll permit me a tangent, because I guess we're kind of done with this, but that, like, there isn't syntactic sugar for that, right? You can't say like await many or what. I mean, you can, but you're using a class and calling an extension.
Or as long as one of these returns, I can start streaming to the client.
Right.
As soon as the first one returns, then chain them together, kind of thing. Yeah.
So that reminds me of another thing that I've been thinking lately, which is that that there's room for a lot, like, there's room for some cooler stuff in C# that I've been thinking of, especially like, you know, doing more JavaScript, and just like when you see things like async and await, then you're like, well, why can't I have this? And one thing was like, some languages have things where you can check for null. Like, basically, if you've got a call, you know, down an inheritance chain, so you say like namespace.class.class, or, you know, and like you have something that, or a method that returns something that returns something that returns something, and you end up having to check each one if it's null along the way. And it'd be nice to be able to say, like, I don't know, whatever. I think something else has like .? Or something like that.
Yeah, CoffeeScript, I think, is it.
Yeah, and it's like, that would be nice, you know. And I was thinking, I mean, I mentioned that on Twitter, and several other people had other nice, like, you know, convenience things where it's like, yeah, you can do it, but there's enough things where it's like, it sure would be nice after, you know, 10 years to have a little bit more of that stuff.
Well, if you're stuck in a place where you have to check for nulls,
yeah,
like some library under control doesn't know enough to return empty objects instead of null, or you know, use a null object kind of thing, you could, at least in C#, you know, you get to coalesce, you get the null coalescing operator. I have ended up using that with almost every piece of database accessing code that I've written.
Yeah, well, and I love the null coalescing operator, and it works well, but it still doesn't work for that thing where you've got like a big chain, because you've got to coalesce each step of that chain, because any way along the line it can barf. And
yeah, that's what I'm saying. I just gotta, okay, if I want the, if the chain should fail if there's a null, that's one thing.
Right.
But if the chain should be able to go on if there's null, and just, hey, you know, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
You need to do something. Then it's kind of, then yeah, you do have to do it at each step and say, all right. But I've, one of the things that I'd thought about was, what if you could use like a func or expression, you know, as the coalesced value in that?
Mm-hmm.
Say, oh, well, you know, so make each step kind of a func, and then, you know, you just say, okay, if it returned null from this, then, you know, call that. Otherwise, use the return value.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's going down crazy.
And somebody pointed me at also like you can use extension methods where you can simplify that. But
to make it read nicer.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Basically,
hey, you know,
it's a safe get.
Record set dot doesn't have the stuff I want.
Right.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We do that a lot too. I was kind of thinking that async is going to be the next. Let me rephrase that. Async programming is going to be the next TDD in terms of driving better design, because suddenly, you know. You want to think a little bit more about state. Like, oh, yeah, you know, if I'm going to have these async methods over here that are accessing this, you know, list, I probably shouldn't make that list, you know, global, or I shouldn't have my methods manipulating the list, you know, in parallel or async or anything.
Right, right.
And I think we're starting to see some more of that, you know, people are complaining about the nested callbacks in Node and, well, you know, you really don't have to do that. You know, you can do this differently. You can actually, return the function that you want to execute from something else instead of, or return an object that has your state in it, and pass that along instead of all these callbacks. But hey, you know, it'll all work out in the end, and someone will release a library, and then we'll all move on to Ada.
I keep wondering when the Xamarin guys are gonna cut the cord and like start innovating on the language itself.
Like not caring about what Microsoft's doing, or
yeah, like
they already did kind of like they had the REPL stuff and the compiler as a service.
They're not changing the language for that.
That's
true.
I would bet against them doing that. Like they seem pretty like. I mean, they've implemented some things ahead of specification. You know, like when something is announced. But I mean, when they were at Build, they were passing out C# shirts. I mean, they seem generally pretty.
What was the what was that high-performance calculation thing they had? Was that built into the runtime, or was that an extra library? You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, SIMD?
Yeah, yeah. That was just another library they were calling, right? Or was that an actual...
That was a compiler. I think that was a... you could compile to take advantage of CPU instructions.
Yeah, yeah. So they're not innovating at the language level there, though. It's just
a compiler
optimization.
And those guys are that's really like the place where those guys just are amazing. It's like they cross-compile to all different kinds of, you know, I mean, they've been doing it forever, but they're compiling to different mobile, to OS X, to you know, they're running stuff on Xbox a long time ago. I mean, just, you know, it runs absolutely everywhere and takes advantage of these really cool low-level things. I mean, they were playing video on multiple platforms, you know, and taking advantage of hardware acceleration.
They were running on ARM before Windows RT was even a dream, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, so that, and that brings me back to an interview that you guys did in DC with James McCoy. Is that right?
John McCoy.
And that was a fascinating podcast where he's talking about, you know, he's not even, I'm not reflecting over C#, I'm modifying the IL and I'm modifying the, you know, outputted assembly to do stuff. Mm-hmm. And that to me seems kind of like what the Xamarin guys do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we might eventually see more of that kind of stuff from Miguel and company at Xamarin,
mm-hmm.
kind of the, let's make the runtime more amazing. But yeah, I don't know what they really do to the language to change it. But it would be nice. But
the real question is like, what does it benefit them to not innovate on the language? Primarily it's backward compatibility with, you know, other platforms like Windows Phone.
And that's kind of the thing. So if I inherit my grandfather's axe and the handle breaks and I replace it, and then the head breaks and I replace it, is it still my grandfather's axe? At some point, they're going to be innovating on the language, and it won't really be C# anymore. It'll be Xamarin.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it would be neat and interesting. I don't see anything from them saying, like, hey, we need a new language. I think what their magic is taking the same MSIL and making it portable and making it, you know, do cool things everywhere. I mean, I don't know. That's a good question to ask them someday. But
it would be nice if someone could, you know, gee, if maybe the C# specification was open enough and maybe the, you know, I don't know, maybe the language itself was, or the compiler parts were open source enough that we could backport and support.
Well, you know that brings back. That brings up Roslyn too. Because I mean, which has been taking a while to happen, but I mean, that's how the script, or what is it, Script.cs works, is, you know, they just took Roslyn and they distributed it over NuGet, and then with that, you've got a compiler, and you can do all kinds, I mean, if you run the compiler, you know what I mean, then you can change the language or add in macros or ahead of time compile magic or whatever, I guess. I don't know. I'm just saying words I've heard people talk about.
Does Roslyn let you do that? I didn't.
I think so. I don't know, honestly. I think, because what these guys are doing, they're defining, like I've been watching in GitHub issues and stuff, and they're like defining new, I think, not new keywords, but they are making it so like if you do pound something, like that'll pull in an assembly or something like that. But, you know, even if not something like Script.cs, you could say like, okay, let's use the Script.cs extensions or let's use whatever extensions. And then you do whatever you're going to do and you use Roslyn to compile instead of the CSC compiler. I'm just making stuff up. Can I ask a completely different question?
Yes.
I'm curious.
Only if you reflectively call back the async IL from the JMP.
Let me unwind the stack a bit here. K. Scott. To wake you up here, you've been doing some stuff with Angular and a bunch of other stuff. I thought it was, you know, we talked to Tom Dale and Rob Connery at NDC. We talked about Ember mostly, but I know you've been doing a ton of stuff with Angular. What are your thoughts on it so far? What have you been up to with it?
I really like it. I've been working on a couple projects with Angular, and I think some things are incredibly easy with Angular and don't require a lot of code. But there are certainly areas in Angular that are a bit frustrating, that get a bit difficult. And reading the source code inside of Angular, I found to be a little bit frustrating sometimes. It's fascinating, yet difficult at the same time.
The source code to Angular itself?
Yes, yes.
Do you have to do that? Like, is that required to use it effectively?
No, I don't think so. The neat thing about Angular is 80% of what you want to do is usually so easy. And then when you get into things like writing custom directives that are not trivial, that are a little bit complicated, well, then it's not well documented and you can find samples on the internet and like a lot of frameworks of this style. There's 12 different ways to do things. And a couple months ago, I decided to just start going through all the Angular source code and trying to figure out what they were doing with each directive. And it was mind-bending.
Yeah,
is it hard to do? I mean, is it like a lot of code to write one of these things, or is it just tricky to figure out the right code?
Yeah, it's not a lot of code, actually, but it's one of those things where there's so many different approaches you could use, different ways to bind from something you're interested in the directive to something on the model, and do I want to bind things? Do I want to watch things? Do I want to raise events when something changes? And, you know, there's so many different ways to approach it, sometimes not even sure which one is going to work or which one's going to run into a limitation.
You know, that's interesting because at the, what do they call it, the cage match, the Ember Angular cage match, like Tom intentionally pushed Rob into a spot where he needed to write a directive, you know, to like keep up. And then Rob had trouble writing the directive on stage, which like it looked a little difficult. And I think it turned out like he missed a parenthesis or something really simple, you know, but it's like that does seem like the thing where there's a huge amount of power with directives, but it does seem like a little bit more like you're at the spot where you kind of really have to think things through and know what you're doing and take some time on it.
Right. And you know, Angular in general, I think the API could use a bit of polish. Someone could really go through and think about the usability of the average programmer trying to put something together with this. For instance, like services, there's 3 or 4 different ways to register a service, which is kind of ridiculous. The methods that you use to register a service don't really have very good names. The obvious method name, .factory, is probably not the one you want to use. And things like that could be cleaned up, made a little bit better, I think.
So I always see And I think people just always want to compare things, but I, like for me, for instance, I'm about to, but I always see like Ember and Angular talked about kind of together. I mean, they do sort of similar things. They have different approaches, but they're pretty different from other like things out there that you'd use for, you know, I don't know, in browser applications. Like, you know, there's Backbone's kind of way over on another side and Knockout.js is kind of pretty different. But it seems like, Angular and Ember are more similar. Have you looked at Ember much? Have you tried it? And, you know, is there a reason that Angular seems more natural for you?
I have looked at Ember a bit and I would like to try it out more. I'm just sort of invested in Angular right now with a couple projects that I'm still working on. I'm really don't feel compelled to that I need to switch it out. So I've been kind of negative about it. In the end, I'm overall very positive about it. I think it's a really great framework. But what was the question?
Well, I was trying to get some controversy out of you, but doesn't seem like
Ember sucks.
Well, I mean, I think Ember's great because I think it does try to provide more of a path. I think there was a lot more thought put into who's going to actually use the framework. Whereas Angular sometimes feels like it's put together as in, hey, what new random thing could we just tackle into here?
How much do you guys think, how do I put this? Like, do you think that, you know, people pick a framework like this, Ember or Angular, and like, how much do you think that kind of locks you into that framework? Like, do people become Ember people and or Angular people and then kind of, you know, it's like, are you picking a stack that you're going to be stuck with for a while? You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I think from a business perspective, in a way, that's true. Once you've invested 6 developer months of time using one framework, it becomes a little more difficult to just swap that out.
Yeah, I think that's the difficulty with frameworks. It's like you either can learn a bunch of them at a very high level, you know, or you can like really actually learn one at a deeper level. Like I've played with Ember a bit. We used it for a demo for Build, and it was like, okay, yeah, this was relatively easy to get started. But I mean, pushed it to the point where like I know where it gets hard, you know. And that's when you like really get to know something is when you use it enough that you run into the problems.
Well, most of the complaints about Ember, at least, have been surrounding the documentation and kind of the general roadmap of the project. Like there's some modules that, you know, they kind of started and they're still mentioned in some of the docs, but they're not in development anymore. And people say, don't use that, use this other thing. And no one really knows, you know, how to get in and get started on stuff. And like they'll file a bug and there's like 5 guys on the team and they don't ever, you know, it's always a matter of, and maybe this may be a wrong impression on my part, but oh, someone else will pick up that bug and fix it. And so the bug just kind of sits there. I don't know if that's kind of what you guys see with Ember as well. The one thing I did notice, and I haven't done anything at work with Angular directly, other than code review some code that another developer at work wrote. But I did notice that when I looked at similar Ember examples to Angular examples, that there was a lot more code in the Ember examples than there was in the Angular. And I don't know if that's just because all the DOM parsing magic stuff that Angular does, or if it just really is a couple more steps to do things in Ember.
It does seem like for the most part, that's true. Like Ember is more declarative and, you know, you like you would write a loop or you would write, you know, like you would, you tell it what to do more. Whereas, I mean, the tiny bit I've looked at Angular is more around like, you know, you've got directives or you've got places where you hook into things. And like you said, the DOM parsing magic kind of, you know, makes stuff happen.
But is that one of those things that's kind of like, you know, no code Visual Studio programming where like, that looks great on these little projects, but once you need to do something real, it turns out, you know, you end up having to work hard to do stuff that the framework doesn't do for you. You know what I mean?
Like yeah, funny you should mention that. I get flashbacks to web forms sometimes with Angular, not in a bad sense, I guess, but in the sense that, you know, you can create new element names with directives. So like the UI, the Bootstrap wrapper that the Angular team put together, if you want to use a Bootstrap I can't think tonight. If you want to set up tabs, you know, Bootstrap style, it would be div class equals tabs, blah, 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 blah. With Angular, it's tab set,
mm-hmm.
which is almost like ASP:\tab set. But
right. It seems like they're trying to align themselves around the web components stuff that's being chewed through the standards process, where you really can do that, you know, sort of like along the same vein as the old Microsoft. What was the Microsoft technology for that? HTC.
Oh, right. Way back. Yeah.
You know, way out, old school.
Yeah.
Where basically you could declare custom elements and bundle in their HTML and CSS. It seems like they're headed, Angular is kind of headed in that direction.
Which is funny because that's coming back again at the standard level. Like people are talking about, you know, web components and then also, but hooking them in at a more, I don't know, in a way where you have like, you know, JavaScript, so it's got fallback, but then later you can advance. I forget what movement or whatever that was. That was a week ago on Hacker News or two. but you know, that kind of idea, people are talking more about components again.
Yeah. I mean, the good thing about directives is if you follow the philosophy correctly, there's still a pretty good separation of concerns. So the directive shouldn't be accessing your web API, things like that. But I've also found directives to be incredibly difficult, pretty much impossible to extend compared to, say, something like the ASP.NET web forms approach. Like in web forms, if you wanted to tweak something, you could just override a class and override one, or derive from it, override one method and change something. Directives are not like that at all. You want to tweak one little thing, you end up going through the source code and re-implementing it.
Yeah, that's that is funny. You know, I've thought about that too. With you very much got into that was the problem with web forms again. You know, it was like, okay, everything works to a point, but then like, if it doesn't work for you and you need to extend it, then you're kind of in a you break it, you bought it spot where it's like you're writing a server control and now you're in a world, in a different world. It's not as happy.
Go off the extensibility cliff.
Yeah.
Everything gets really, really hard. That always drove me nuts with a lot of Microsoft stuff. I mean, that was more than just web forms. That was true. And even in the old Win32 days.
Mm-hmm. All right. Do you guys want to talk document databases?
Sure. So 2011.
I know. So I finally actually got to use one sort of in Angular. I used Redis, and I had a lot of fun with it. I used the service stack stuff for it. Okay, Scott, you had a blog post, and I kind of took a little further. I had some stuff that had been written to like very simple Azure Table Storage, which is sort of similar to Redis, except less extensible. You can't do as much with it. And we wanted to do a little bit more analytics and stuff. And they've added some pretty cool stuff on, like you can do Lua scripting and you can, there are query options to it. There's really none with Azure Table Storage, but it's super fast and it took a little bit for me to set up the machine, but it was like, wow, it was pretty fun. You do have to think differently, of course. I mean, I guess that's totally obvious, but like, you know, like for instance, if you're going to query on something, you may just write out some duplicates, you know, write out some index tables as well, like on the fly. But you're in control of that as opposed to like the traditional relational database where you just fill up a bunch of tables and worry about it later. Okay, Scott, you said you've been using Mongo lately?
Yeah, the team I work with at a company in Maryland, we've built a product that's been certified as to sell to hospitals to help manage quality indicators at hospitals. And behind the scenes, it's a MongoDB database. Fascinating, I can hear you say.
Is there anything you can say about your experiences with that, or is it all super secret?
No, not super secret. I'd say we're still learning about Mongo on a weekly basis.
I feel like Mongo, there's a certain group of people in the development community who sort of poo-poo Mongo and don't think it's well-written and, you know, has all kinds of issues. I'm curious if you've run into things.
Well, I guess the biggest thing is performance. It takes some time to... I mean, you just got to do all the things that you have to do for performance up front, make sure you benchmark things and experiment with things and actually try out the database with the data that you expect to see in production. It's tricky. And the tooling around diagnosing things in that area isn't quite there.
Kevin, I think you were using MongoDB on some things lately, weren't you?
Yeah. Well, I used it on greater than parts. I mean, that was my primary data storage.
Right.
But then also, I don't know if this has been announced on the podcast, but I accepted a new job back in like May. So I'm now working for a startup in San Francisco called Brandcast. And we are actually in the process of migrating over to use Mongo as our primary storage also.
What are you migrating from?
MySQL.
Ah, cool.
Yeah, so it's just a better fit for some of the stuff that we're doing. And Like you said, John, I mean, the biggest thing with document databases is just figuring out how to model things. You know, when you come from a relational mindset, it's definitely an adjustment to figure out, you know, what things do you embed, what things do you reference. There's definitely a learning curve there.
It's funny because, like, the impression I have, I mean, we've done podcasts with people, you know, who do document databases and have read about them and all that kind of thing. But until playing with it, I still had the impression in my mind, it's just like, it's just a pile and you throw a bunch of documents in it and you don't really care about, you know, you just throw stuff in and worry about it later. And I mean, that was my, you know, week's worth of impression about it too, was like, you do model, it's just different, you know, like you do, you know, yeah, it's great. You can throw documents in, but you know, if you want to be able to query on them later, if you want to get to things in a certain way, then, you know, you just have to, you know, write things out separately or write out duplicates or however you do.
Yeah, and yep. You will be doing migrations.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Cause you don't have a rigid table structure anymore.
Right. But you'll still be doing some migrations now and then.
Well, I won't. I'm done with this thing.
Because you would want to like renormalize your data, like you made some tweaks to the data structure and you want to apply it to old data. Is that what you mean?
Right. Situations like that. And in general, just some sort of configuration management around your Mongo database. So sure, you don't have to set up a schema. You don't have to have any collections in place when you start with Mongo. But when you actually ship something, you'll want to make sure that the proper indexes are applied before the application gets started and those sorts of things.
Well, and you probably want to be able to either roll back to an earlier, will we say schema, configuration, or be able to apply like incremental changes. Like you wouldn't go and just make all the changes in the prod data manually, right? You'd want us to have them scripted out somehow.
Exactly. Yeah, right. So, I mean, so you discover an issue with the way you've modeled data that's killing the server when it's running some sort of MapReduce. So now you figured out a better way to model the data, and it has to be migrated and shifted around somehow. And you want to do that in a consistent way. So someone's going to be writing something that's like a migration script.
So, K. Scott, did you run into issues where you were dealing with the fact that you suddenly, you know, in the document database world or in the Mongo world, you don't have transactions anymore? So now if you have to do multiple writes, you know, you need to adjust for the fact that one of those may fail. Like, is that a scenario that you've had to deal with?
Fortunately, no. Kind of got off easy there because this application is mostly about bulk loading patient data into it. And then everything else is just algorithms and reports off of that. There's not really many write transactions to the database after it gets loaded. There's periodic loads, but those go into a staging area.
Well, lucky you.
Yes. Sorry.
So, Kevin, you mentioned the new job. You want to tell us any more about it?
Sure. As I mentioned, it's at a small company in San Francisco called Brandcast. We're sort of on a mission to make it easy for non-technical people to make a web presence in a really super dead simple way that looks good and is like responsive and works on mobile devices and you know, without having any kind of technical background. So you can sort of think of it like, you know, sort of Squarespace-y, but even more targeted at people who, you know, to make it just super simple to do that. And it's a great company. It's a great group of guys. It's all JavaScript shops, Node on the back end, and Backbone stuff on the front end. So it's been very fun and very interesting.
Cool. It's been fun and interesting hearing over the years, like you kind of made this decision. You wanted to pick, you know, like you've gotten into Node, you've gotten into Backbone, and it's cool. You're able to, you know, dig into that.
Yeah. Somebody's paying me to do it.
That's cool. And you were telling me we met up when I was in San Francisco this summer. You're now the old guy in the shop, right?
I am. I went from being like the young guy at my old company to like by far the old guy at the new company. So that's a bit of a adjustment.
Do they have like it's a small shop? Do they have like, you know, I don't know, what's the like development process like? Is it like quick throw stuff out on production, or is it kind of like a, you know, I don't know, integration and testing and all that kind of stuff?
Process. What's that? we are set up to do like really flat, fast deploys, and we try to do that when we can. We do have a test server that we deploy to if we want to do, like, you know, if we're doing like major database migrations, we want to test that against a test server before we push it to production. But we do try to, you know, push continuous deployment, right? We do try to push aggressively if we're, you know, if it's the kind of change that we can just get out there. But it's definitely, you know, it's definitely a small company, you know, fairly loose, not a lot of structure. But we like to iterate quickly. So
cool. Are you picking up new things with different ways of using Backbone? Like, from my understanding from talking to you and other interviews we've done and stuff, like, a lot of time you'll use something like Marionette, or you'll use frameworks on top of Backbone.
Yep.
Do they have custom frameworks, or are they using some common ones? Or
I've definitely learned a lot on that, actually, because they use they do use some different frameworks than I've used. I've used Marionette in the past, and they used Backbone Layout Manager as sort of like the higher level thing on top of the view management piece. And then a project called Supermodel, which is a Backbone sort of it's Backbone model plugin for doing like relationships between objects, and so you can say, you know, Backbone itself has no notion of like this object has these child objects which have these child objects, and so it adds that layer onto Backbone. So that's been pretty interesting. And then we have our own like whole framework on top of all of that, some of which kind of bends Backbone to do things that it probably was not originally intended to do. But yeah, so I've definitely been learning a ton.
Cool. Well, I could tell you guys about some new stuff that's maybe interesting about the Herding Code website and stuff. Is that interesting?
Sure.
Okay, so here's the funny thing. We've been running for 5 years now, high fives everyone, on a shared WordPress hosting account, and it's kind of like it's the minimum thing, like it's, I don't know, $7 a month or something like that. And so a lot of it's been, you know, like looking at, you know, keeping under the radar, like, you know, they have limits where you get use enough and then they'll boot you up to another system. And there's other things out there. I've talked to other people that are hosting podcasts on stuff like Libsyn is a good one, Libsyn, or you know, you can put the MP3s up on Azure or Amazon Web Storage or whatever. But I've just kept them up there, S3. Yeah. So I've just kept them up on the server, and we run kind of a standard WordPress. But some things we've been doing lately, I use Cloudflare. So Cloudflare is kind of a cool front service you can put on it. So you set them to be your DNS provider, and the requests come through Cloudflare and then come to your site. And what's cool with that is they cache a lot of stuff, and they also do a lot of, like, they do some security checking. So they bounce things from, like, known botnets. They bounce things from, like, malicious and you know, they have like all these kind of like security levels. So some people, like if you're on a, like a subnet that has a known botnet, like you'll get a captcha page or something. And we had a few complaints about that at the beginning, and I tuned it and I don't hear anything anymore. But when I go and look at it, like it blocks out a huge amount of attacks. And then speaking of security, WordPress attacks are just constant. People are always hacking WordPress, and it's kind of a known entity, and it's PHP, so it's and people also leave the defaults, and so it's pretty easy to just do automated attacks on it. So some things I've been doing with that. One is I set up a plugin that does a lockout. So if there's enough incorrect lockouts from an IP in a time range, then it locks that IP address for a while, and if they continue, then it just blocks that IP. So that's kind of cool. And then I put a very long password on it, and then I use OpenID to log in for the most part. So, you know, it's harder to attack that way. Let me see what one other kind of neat thing that I did recently. They had an update where the latest release of WordPress just came out a few weeks ago, has support for Media Element JS. And what's nice with that is it runs kind of on top of HTML5 audio. And so it'll fall back to Flash or Silverlight as needed for different platforms. But for the most part, it just uses HTML5 audio element, and then it styles it to look the same everywhere. And I'd been noticing that a lot of sites have playing indicators in the title bar of the site. So like when you've got a bunch of tabs open and one of them is playing audio, but you don't know which one and you want to make the noise stop. It can be kind of frustrating. And so I just wrote some JavaScript that basically like iterates, like when an audio event happens on the page, it checks and sees if any of the audio elements are playing. And then it puts a little play icon up in the title bar if it's playing. And I'd notice that like on a bunch of sites like SoundCloud and YouTube and Bandcamp. And like that's just kind of become a de facto standard. So it took like 6 lines of JavaScript code. So it was kind of neat. There's probably some other stuff, but that's some of the main things. And then K. Scott Allen, you said on the chat here that we need a mobile app. And I used a WordPress plugin that does a mobile theme. So if people come for, and it's, you know, it's the cheesy browser sniffing thing. But if it detects a known mobile user agent, then it shows kind of a you know, mobile friendly view. And then HTML5 audio normally handles that. So anyhow, that's kind of some of the interesting things there. I just kind of randomly do some of this stuff in the background. I thought I'd mention some of it. That might be interesting. Anybody think that's all wrong?
Terrible. Put it all back.
Yeah. And yeah, I just thought that was kind of, I'm surprised, honestly. Like I was kind of like, first of all, I didn't think we'd keep doing this for years. But then like, I was like, well, we'll just see how long we can get away with this, you know, like shared hosting account. It turns out 5 years plus, which is kind of funny.
And the times that we've gotten into trouble have been, I mean, we have had issues where our CPU usage went way up, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so part of that was, well, I mentioned one of the things was Cloudflare. So that does like a front-end cache, which is cool. So like most of the time people aren't even hitting our server. They're just hitting Cloudflare. And we have a free account there. Like there's more you can do, but we are just at the free level. And then also I turned on, there's several like, I don't know, kind of more advanced performance plugins you can get. And I use W3 Total Cache, and it does all this kind of like page level caching.
Does it output the static files?
Yeah.
For some of the older pages or something like that?
Right, right. So it does all that caching. I believe that it caches to database, although you can also set it up to cache to disk. But yeah, so and there's a huge amount of options, and I've configured just a few of them. But, you know, for the most part, it's like, yeah, so there's kind of 2 levels of caching there. And it's amazing what you can get away with if you just cache a lot of stuff. You know, the one frustrating thing when I was first getting this set up was I used to, like, if I published something from hotel Wi-Fi and I, like, screwed it up, like the MP3 link was wrong or, you know, I'd misspelled the guest's name or you know, something like that, then, like, I would post the update once I could get Wi-Fi working, and it was cached forever. So, you know, it took me a little bit to like understand, you know, figure out that kind of stuff. So now, like, basically whenever I publish something, it goes live immediately, but until then it's cached kind of forever.
So, but the caching is really all on just the HTML page generation, right?
It does some database level caching stuff too.
But we haven't like had any issues with the like hitting bandwidth peaks on the actual MP3 files, right?
No, not at all. No. And I believe from what I can see on the Cloudflare reports is that they serve a lot of that stuff too. Like,
oh, really?
Yeah. Which is, I mean, it's pretty insane that like for the free level of service, they'll say like, yeah, we've served this many gigabytes of traffic for you this month. And it's like, well, thanks guys. You know? So, and they have all kinds of great services too, great add-ons and stuff. Okay.
How much are they paying you here? What's going on?
Yeah, I know.
I have heard lots and lots of good things about CloudFront.
Yeah, Cloudflare is the one I used.
Oh, Cloudflare, not Cloud. CloudFront is the Amazon one, right?
Yes. Yep.
So if we're gonna suck up, we want to suck up to the right company.
Yeah. You know, I forget. I think I'd read something on like Hacker News or on the internets at large. And at the exact same time, like our account was disabled for going way over the CPU limits and all this stuff. And so I was like, well, you know, I might as well give this a shot before I pay for a new server. And, it all kind of magically worked. And I was like, well, okay then. So yeah, I was just looking at it today, looking at stats and everything. It's like, block these 5 botnets in Iran and serve this many gigabytes for you. And, you know, if you want to pay for more service, you can, but you know, so.
So K. Scott brought up an interesting point, and I've been thinking about this too, is for sites that are primarily just like a podcast, do we need to make a mobile app, or do we just make our site responsive and lean on the audio element for kind of playback of episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so if we did make an app, it would be kind of, we wouldn't want it to just be, hey, this, you know, shows the latest, you know, show, you know, or let you go through and scroll through the archives or anything. I was trying to think of what kind of value add could we give to an MVP mobile app, you know, most minimal viable product.
Right.
And, you know, there's the usual, you can tweet it, you can Facebook it, and this. Yeah, we can do that with a plain HTML thing. And I was, you know, I was racking my brain. I was like, okay, so maybe not necessarily a feedback, but show suggestion, or if there's a way that we could like make it more interactive for the listeners rather than, cause like it'd almost be like a forum is kind of what I'm thinking of,
mm-hmm.
but maybe more of a Jabber talk room / forums, you know, kind of Stack Overflow thing. So, hey, when we talk about something on the show, you can diverge and have a discussion somehow
yeah.
about that thing.
You know, that's an interesting idea. I've been like recently I got this Mac Mini so that I could play with Xamarin, and then I got a Windows phone, which is kind of more fun to develop for than Android, and so I've been thinking about like, yeah, it would be cool to make a mobile app kind of just because. Like, I don't really feel like it's needed, but why not, you know? But yeah, that does make a lot of sense. That reminds me too of one thing, which is when I was kind of profiling stuff, the only thing that really does change on a podcast page normally is the comments. And so I outsource that to Discuss. And some people like or dislike Discuss. I kind of like it in general. Like, I like that you can set options on it and that it, you know, can send notifications and you have one login, and, but it does kind of like keep track of who's who and stuff.
Yeah, it's nice, the moderator features where, you know, you get an email, you reply, say approve, deny. But recently they made a change where they start inserting their own ads.
Yeah.
Into it. So I noticed when you go to our page now and view the comments, it's like, here's another thing about this podcast you might like.
Yeah, there's some pretty and ridiculously then, like not...
Here's all these, you know, weird sites that, you know, what are these? They're from around the web. Who cares about this woman who was texting, you know, right. the senator her new porn site?
Well, now
I have a visitor.
Yeah.
She's loud.
Discuss seems to be headed down that road. Like, they're headed off a cliff, it looks like.
Yeah, I kind of hope
like,
not.
Oh, we actually have to make money at this internet stuff, huh?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And as an example right now, if you look at our latest podcast from around the web, the second around the web result is French Kissing, How to Do It the Right Way. Now, which actually may be of interest to our listeners. I don't know, but it's sort of off topic for most of our shows. But yeah,
I would say given our audience that it's very off topic.
But it has been, I have to say, it's like simplified both, like the spam goes away, like their spam moderation is awesome, except for the ad spam that they insert. But the actual comment spam has gone away, and then it's just a, you know, like a script tag that embeds a div in the page, and so like there's no database query for it at all.
Is there anybody else doing this? Because I feel like there's this chunk of the internet where people have started moving towards statically generated blog sites, and they can get away with this partly because Discuss provides their commenting system.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to. But now if Discuss is going down, you know, started to, you know, climb Douchebag Mountain. like, is it, you know, what's going to happen? Like, are we all going to have to come up with something new? Is it going to, you know, cause a ripple effect through the ecosystem?
That's funny. I have talked to a lot of people that are doing everything on Jekyll, or, you know, different statically generated pages. And, you know, Miguel's done his blog on that for, like, his has been HTML for a very long time. And sometimes when that happens, when one service provider goes too far down, or up Douchebag Mountain, as you said, then somebody else comes along and like goes back to what they originally provided. So I don't know. I haven't looked around if there's somebody else out there. It's right now, it's kind of like right on the edge. Like, it's definitely like, it's nice for a lot of reasons. And then it's just a little too much with the around the web business.
Yeah. And once companies start going this way, like, it usually only gets worse. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Any other? Let me see. How long has it been? It's been roughly an hour. Do we have any other?
Do you guys have any what you did with your summer kind of some things you want to talk about?
I can do that.
I've got you all beat. I had to maintain an app and add a new feature to said app that was written in Monorail using the Brails engine.
Wow.
Kicking it old school.
That was all .NET before, like, all .NET thought about being all .NET.
Yeah, Brails used Boo.
Yeah. You know, Boo looked like such a cool language, but the second I saw it announced, I was like, no, you picked a name that nobody is ever going to, like, if they called it, like, B-sharp or pretty much anything but Boo, I think it might have taken off. Maybe not. Well, how was that?
It was not too bad. It took me a little while to figure out the put a colon at the end of some things and not others. And it was still kind of the biggest problem was that Visual Studio didn't seem to recognize it as any kind of web page thing. So it would complain about all these XML errors when I would try to compile unless I closed all of the .brails file.
Mm.
And it took me a little while because I never really did much Monorail programming at all. So I kind of thought, oh, well, I'll just go read the docs for this. Except that apparently when they decided to rewrite Monorail in F#, they like scorched the earth. So my only source of documentation for this Monorail code was, well, the code that I had there itself, and I think 122 questions on Stack Overflow. And, you know, various blog posts throughout the web, which referenced various versions, various unstated versions of Monorail. So I wasn't ever sure if what they were showing me was going to work or not, or if that was an earlier version or a later version or what was going on.
Did you have the source, the Monorail source?
No, we didn't have the source.
Oof.
In fact, they not only scorched the documentation, but they pulled Monorail 2 off of NuGet when they decided to rewrite too. So we actually had to host the NuGet package locally on our own NuGet server internally.
Lame.
Wow.
And yeah, you know, so the only thing that saved me was I ended up not doing a lot of Brails code because I just made all the controller methods return the JSON return binder, and then I just added the feature using JavaScript.
This is why I am not a fan of running package management install as part of your deployment. Like, that stuff should be checked into your code base. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
Like, they pulled it off. Like, if you were relying on that package as part of your deployment, you are screwed.
Yeah. It's funny. This reminds me of way back in the day, I was working on this thing, and it was I forget if it was a classic ASP or an ASP.NET site. It doesn't matter, because the problem was we were trying to migrate off of a SQL server, and there was, like, just a few stored procedures that they needed moved. And they're like, okay, John, you do these. So I'm looking at it. I'm like, how hard could this be? And of course it was hard because it relied on a trigger. And then I start digging into the trigger, and the trigger was back in this short period of time where somebody was advising that you SQL Server could call COM objects. And so it was doing like SP underscore OA create, whatever it was, but it was creating COM objects. And so then I go and find, I ask everyone in the company basically for the source of this, and it turned out it was like a VB6 COM object, and it was back and forth, but it was basically like it was ASP code that called a stored procedure that called a COM object, and all the COM object did was concatenate strings or split, like you could pass in comma delimited strings and it would split them into parameters. You know what I mean? How that's always a pain, like when you want to match on multiple COM and delimited strings. So anyhow, that's all that COM object did. But it took like tons of like detective work for, like, I forget what we did, but it like turned into three lines of T-SQL. I'm sorry, that's not what I did with my summer vacation at all. Kevin, you told us a little bit about what you did with your summer vacation. You got a new job.
Yeah, that was it. And then I actually did some vacationing, so that was fun.
Where'd you go?
Went to Paris and Switzerland and San Diego.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was the summer of travel. So, John, what about you?
Let me see. Well, I started off the right way. Kay Scott and I were over at NDC. So that was kind of neat. And then I got back and I was behind the scenes, for Scott Hanselman's 10-minute keynote demo at Build. And it was to show off like what's new in Visual Studio 2013 and ASP.NET. And like we wanted to show off cool web dev features and stuff. And so that was, we ended up doing like, it was using Ember.js on the front end and it was using SignalR and so, so it was really cool. It was amazing to like, I mean, we were tweaking to get to cut seconds off of this thing, and I worked on just that, like that 10 minutes. I basically worked on that for a month, and we had other developers that were like behind the scenes helping with stuff, reset scripts and everything so we could run through it over and over. So yeah, that was interesting. And soon after, I was kind of on vacation in quotes in New Jersey later, for family vacation and stuff, and weddings and that kind of thing. So that was cool. Went to Sandy Hook, New Jersey, which is somewhere I'd never been. I guess that's all. Okay, Scott.
I worked a lot, actually.
All right.
Yeah, really, really exciting.
But you're in Ohio now, so come on. How can you complain?
I'll have really exciting stories over the next 3 months, though.
Because?
Well, it's a big secret, but it'll be very exciting.
All right.
Are you going to retire and go off and spend your millions that you've earned from your training?
He did have a very nice article written about him.
Yes, he did.
Congratulations. So that was saying you were highly exalted for your Pluralsight courses. So anybody listening that doesn't know about K-Scott's Pluralsight courses, go get them all.
The only offer I got was a Facebook-sponsored ad that said I could be a substance abuse counselor for $50,000 a year. I thought I could see that. I could be a good substance abuse counselor. Yeah. You just go in there and you say, "Stop doing drugs, dummy! Stop doing drugs, dummy!"
Well, but you're in Washington State now, right? So I heard now you just hand out Doritos
with yeah, helpful advice like listen to Pink Floyd, but just not that loud.
And on that note, should we wrap up? Anyone else want to talk about anything else? You guys are killing me. No? Yes?
You're killing me, Smalls.
I'm going to make somebody say that's it.
That's it?
All right.
No more.
Okay. That's it. The end.
I can't take K-Scott's constant babbling.
All right. Cool. The end. I'm not even going to say the words.